I didn't realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a backseat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills, so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Welcome back to Behind the Knife's Absite Review Series. Today I just wanted to take a quick second to give people that are struggling a little bit of a pep talk. I know this is a rough time of year. You've been an intern or a junior resident for half of the year and your motivation is waning and you're spending your free time studying for the Absite and listening to this podcast, which I'm sure there's many other things you'd like to do. Just remember how far you've come. Many people would kill to be in your shoes. And if you would have imagined yourself as a surgical trainee 5-10 years ago, and at this point in your life, you'd be quite excited and quite proud. So don't lose sight of that and how far you've come. And soon the Absite will be over and you'll have done well and you'll be moving on to your surgical practice. So keep the goal in mind. One quick quote from John Maxwell. Successful and unsuccessful people do not vary greatly in their abilities. They vary in their desires to reach their potential. John Maxwell. Okay, that's your pep talk from Kevin. Good luck on colorectal part two.
All right, colorectal part two for the Absite and the boards. This is a huge topic. We've broken it up into two. We're just trying to give you those key recommendations and those big topics that are going to help you out with the boards. Obviously, any one of these could be a podcast on their own. So let's keep rolling with it. So let's move on to our inflammatory bowel diseases. So let's start with ulcerative colitis. Woo. What is ulcerative colitis and who does it affect?
Yeah, so UC is a chronic inflammatory condition. It affects the rectum and extends proximally. The key is that it spares the anus. It's a mucosal-based disease. It's contiguous. And some characteristics that it has, it develops crypt abscesses and pseudopolyps.
Yeah, so there's a lot of energy goes into really distinguishing ulcerative colitis from Crohn's disease. So those are kind of the, you know, those buzzwords, those key things that is characteristic of ulcerative colitis. Inflammatory condition from a rectum extending proximally, mucosal, contiguous, crypt abscesses, pseudopolyps are all things that are characteristic. What are some keys to management?
Yeah, so most cases are managed medically, with 15-30% of patients eventually requiring surgery. The mainstay for acute flares is steroids. And then for maintenance therapy, you want to use mesalamine or infliximab if resistant.
Yeah, so it's kind of a stepwise approach. Steroids, obviously, for your acute flares. Mesalamine maintenance, adding infliximab later for more resistant diseases. Kevin, what are some surgical indications for ulcerative colitis?
So some surgical indications. So patients that do not respond to medical management, so medical intractability, they're on high doses of steroids and immunologics, and they're still not getting better, or they just don't want to be on those medications, this would be an indication. Malignancy or any kind of polyps with dysplasia would be an indication. And then other complications such as stricture, perforation, or fulminant/toxic colitis.
Okay, and you mentioned medical intractability. What do we mean when we say medical intractability for Crohn's or for ulcerative colitis?
So for medical intractability, you want to think about patients who are worsening on medical therapy or just simply not getting better. And this is somewhat vague, but essentially it means that the patient cannot achieve an adequate quality of life despite being on that mesalamine for maintenance plus the infliximab as well as the steroids for the acute flares. They're just not getting better. Additionally, as a separate component that's a big key is any amount of growth failure in children. That's another indication for medical intractability.
Yeah, like you said, it's somewhat vague. The growth failure in children, that's definitely a big one. Patients who aren't getting better despite maximum medical therapy, or the risk of chronic medical therapy isn't tolerated. Obviously, you can't keep somebody on steroids forever. There's side effects to that. Another one would be the disabling extraintestinal manifestations that may respond to colectomy, such as your arthropathies, erythema nodosum. Kevin, what about those hepatobiliary manifestations? Do those get better with a colectomy or not?
The hepatobiliary manifestations generally do not get better after colectomy.
Right. Now, the hepatobiliary is the one that does not get better after performing a total abdominal colectomy. So that's an important one to know.
Which is primary sclerosing cholangitis.
Correct. So we talked to me a little bit about, we mentioned earlier that malignancy would be an indication for a procedure in a patient with ulcerative colitis. What's the association between colorectal malignancy and ulcerative colitis?
So ulcerative colitis does purport an increased risk of developing malignancy later on. And this is why Kevin mentioned any degree of dysplasia even is an indication for a surgical removal. So for surveillance, the unique recommendations are essentially any patient with extensive colitis that's proximal to the splenic flexure, you want to do endoscopy after 8 years of disease and then every 1 to 2 years following that. When you do these endoscopies, make sure you do 4-quadrant random biopsies at 10-centimeter intervals throughout the disease segment of the colon, along with any directed biopsies of suspicious lesions.
Yep, that's very important. Those are your surveillance recommendations for ulcerative colitis in patients who have pancolitis, so proximal to the splenic flexure. After 8 years of disease, endoscopy every 1 to 2 years, your 4-quadrant random biopsies. Kevin, what if you see, we mentioned it briefly, but what if you see high-grade dysplasia on your surveillance biopsies?
That would be an indication for a colectomy.
Yep, and specifically, not just colectomy, what's the specific operation you need to do in that?
A total proctocolectomy with or without an IPAA.
Right, not just a colectomy, a total proctocolectomy for high-grade dysplasia on your surveillance biopsy for ulcerative colitis, proctocolectomy. Okay, so let's move on to some of the different surgical treatments for ulcerative colitis. So, Wu, let's say you're in an emergent setting. So, your toxic colitis, your perforation in a patient with UC, what's your procedure?
So, here I'd start with a total or subtotal colectomy with an end ileostomy. You can later perform a completion proctectomy and IPAA if you need to, but in an emergent setting, start with a total or subtotal colectomy.
Right. At that point, you're controlling your contamination. So a total or subtotal colectomy and ileostomy. Later, you can do your reconstruction. You can do your completion proctectomy. How about, Kevin, in a more kind of elective setting? What are your surgical options?
So in the elective setting, they're generally obviously not ill, so you can actually do the full procedure at once. You can do the total proctocolectomy with an end ileostomy. So you get the whole colon and rectum out of there. This removes all the pathologic tissue, but this would commit the patient to a lifelong ileostomy.
So what's a more common procedure that we're seeing these days?
So if it's a young patient, generally under 50 years old with good sphincter complex and no history of any sort of incontinence, you could do a total proctocolectomy with a ileopouch anal anastomosis. So this has the advantage of they don't have a stoma, but they may have complications related to their pouch, but most can achieve a good quality of life.
Yeah, and you mentioned that very important. They must have good baseline continence prior to constructing your pouch. And another key thing is, you know, we talked a lot, as I said before, a lot of energy goes into distinguishing ulcerative colitis from Crohn's disease, but you have to be sure that it's UC and not Crohn's, because the diseased ileum does not make for a good ileal pouch. There's one other option out there. What is that?
Yeah, so another option would be a total abdominal colectomy with an ileorectal anastomosis, but really these are only used in highly select cases. You absolutely must have uninvolved rectum, which is pretty rare in the setting of ulcerative colitis, and the rectum is still at risk for ongoing disease and cancer, so you need specific annual surveillance for the residual rectal cuff.
Yeah, so I think the most common, I think the answer on the test is generally going to be the total proctocolectomy with IPAA. As long as you have, it's a good option for that patient. As Kevin said, they had good continence or younger patients, that type of thing. Certainly these others are options, but that's going to be your most common procedure you're going to see. Okay, so let's move on to Crohn's disease. So Wu, how do we distinguish ulcerative colitis from Crohn's? What are some key characteristics of Crohn's disease?
So again, Crohn's disease is chronic, but the key differences are it is a transmural inflammation. It's segmental, so not continuous like UC was. There's a characteristic creeping fat. And then there are several different phenotypes that you want to keep in mind. So there's an inflammatory variant, there's a fibrostenotic variant, and there's penetrating. And these can also overlap and change, but overall, three overarching phenotypes.
So Kevin, what are some extra-intestinal manifestations of Crohn's disease?
So commonly you can see arthritis and arthralgias. You can see megaloblastic anemia. And the reason for that is they have difficulty with absorption of B12 in the terminal ileum because it's chronically inflamed. You can see uveitis. And then the kind of bored answer is erythema nodosum.
Okay. And so how about what's medical management of Crohn's disease? It's similar to UC, but just let's restate it just so we have it down.
Right. So medical management is steroids for acute flares. A lot of times with mild disease, you can manage them with 5-ASA/mesalamine for maintenance. And then more severe cases that don't respond to that, you can have them on Remicade or other newer biologics for resistant disease.
Okay. And so we talked about surgery for UC for patients who can't tolerate or don't want to be on lifelong medical therapy, that we have a curative surgery. Is that the same for Crohn's disease, Wu?
No. So unlike UC, there's no surgical cure. So instead, surgery is reserved for complications of the disease, like strictures, obstructions, perforation, fistula, or for malignancy.
Exactly. So surgery for Crohn's disease is reserved only for complications, those things you said. And a key surgical principle is to preserve as much small bowel as possible because these patients will often require multiple resections over the course of a lifetime. So Kevin, let's talk a little bit more about that. So a common complication is strictures. So how do you want to manage your symptomatic stricture in a patient with Crohn's disease?
So these are patients that... You have two options. You can either do a resection, which is commonly performed if it's a very short segment of disease. But if you have multiple segments of disease that would potentially be debilitating to resect that much bowel, you can do a strictureoplasty.
Before we get there, like I said, we always start with the least invasive and go to more invasive. Is there another option other than surgery for patients with a symptomatic stricture?
Right. At advanced centers, they can try endoscopic dilation.
Yeah, if you can reach it endoscopically, you can try an endoscopic dilation with these strictures. But then if you can't, you can move on to either resection or strictureoplasty. So talk to me a little bit more about that. What are some options for strictureoplasty? How do you choose which procedure you're going to do?
This is very testable and has been a question many times where they'll give you different types of strictures and you have to tell them what type of strictureoplasty you do. So if you're near a computer right now, I would start Googling these and know what they look like and what they're used for, but we'll try our best to describe it. So if you have a very short stricture, you can do the Heinicke-Mikulicz strictureoplasty.
And what is that?
That is where you make a longitudinal incision on the stricture and then you close it transversely.
Okay. What's roughly the size stricture that you would want to do that for?
Less than 10 centimeters.
Yeah. So I think you move from, if you have an isolated short segment disease, you can do resection and that's really the most commonly performed. But if you have multiple strictures, and you're trying to preserve bowel length, these strictureoplasties for short strictures, the Heinicke-Mikulicz strictureoplasty. What about for medium length strictures?
So the ones that are 10, 20 centimeters, you can consider the Finney strictureoplasty.
Okay, and can you do your best to describe that?
Yeah, this is where you you take the stricture and you kind of fold it on itself, and then you open the bowel on either end and then sew a common wall together to make it all one piece of bowel.
Okay, what about for longer strictures? Let's say you have a long segment, a 20-plus centimeter segment of small bowel that's strictured.
So this is kind of similar to the Finney strictureoplasty. It's sometimes called a side-to-side isoperistaltic strictureoplasty.
Yeah, I'm not going to make you try and describe that one. But yeah. Again, like Kevin said, I would start Googling this if you're near a computer, just so you have an idea in your head of what these look like and what your different options are. Okay, so what are some other kind of key What are some key surgical principles when we're performing your stricturoplasty?
Yeah, there are actually two key surgical principles that you do not want to forget. The first is make sure you biopsy the strictured segment. You absolutely do not want to inadvertently leave behind a malignancy for the sake of purely preserving bowel length. The second principle is if there is any evidence of malnutrition, inflammation, perforation, fistula, or again, suspicion for malignancy, these are contraindications to strictureplasty. So again, don't just jump to it simply because you want to preserve bowel. You want to remember these principles as well.
Absolutely. You want to keep those things in mind. Okay, so let's move on to talk about some of our different colorectal malignancies. Let's start with colon cancer. First, let's start with some different screening and surveillance recommendations, because these are, A, they're important to know in clinical practice, and two, they show up frequently on tests. So what's your surveillance recommendation, Wu, for an asymptomatic patient who you deem to be average risk for colon cancer?
So this patient can start colonoscopy at age 50 and repeat every 10 years if normal. Alternatively, if the patient prefers, they can do a sigmoidoscopy every 5 years plus fecal occult blood testing annually.
Yep. So that's just your average risk patient. That's all comers out there. Those are the recommendations. Colonoscopy starting at age 50, repeat every 10 years if normal. Okay, Kevin, how about if you have a first degree relative with colorectal cancer or adenomas diagnosed before the age of 60, or let's say you have two first degree relatives diagnosed with colon cancer at any age?
So the general recommendation for these patients is to start with a colonoscopy every decrease the interval to every 5 years, and you want to start at the age of 40 or 10 years prior to the age of the youngest effective relative, whichever is first.
Yeah. So those are your patients that are a little bit increased risk. So they have first degree relative, like I said, before age 60 or two first degree relatives at any age, colonoscopy at 5 years starting at age 40. Okay. Woo. Next, you have a first degree relative diagnosed with colon cancer after age 60 or two second degree relatives. What do you want to do for those patients?
So I'd start with colonoscopy at age 40 and do it every 10 years.
Yeah, so just a little bit different. So first degree relative over age 60, again, starting at 40, but then the interval is every 10 years. Kevin, you have a secondary relative, one secondary relative with colorectal cancer.
So these would be just screened as average risk.
Right. So that those are not increased risk. They don't require earlier colonoscopy. They don't require increased interval. So colonoscopy at age 50 and then every 10 years. So that's for a secondary relative. Okay, so Wu, how about FAP patients? First off, what is FAP and how do you screen those patients?
So FAP is familial adenomatous polyposis. For these patients, you want to start very early at age 10 to 12 and you're going to do an annual sigmoidoscopy.
Okay, how about your other hereditary? So your hereditary non-polyposis colorectal cancer, how do you want to screen those patients?
Yeah, for HNPCC, you're going to do a colonoscopy every 1 to 2 years starting at age 20 to 25 or 10 years prior to the youngest diagnosed relative.
Okay, so yeah, those are all a little bit painful, but they're all very important to know. Again, both clinically, they're important to know, and these will show up on tests. They'll give you a patient. They'll say, how do you want to screen these patients? All right, so Kevin, let's move on to patients with a personal history of adenoma. So let's say you perform a colonoscopy, and this is what you find. You need to know what to tell the patient. So let's say you find one to two small tubular adenomas. What's the repeat colonoscopy interval for those patients?
So small adenomas, less than two and less than 5 millimeters in size, repeat colonoscopy in 5 years.
Yep. So that's a couple, 1 to 2 tubular adenomas, benign tubular adenomas. They need a repeat colonoscopy in 5 years. Let's say you find 3 or more adenomas. What do you want to tell that patient?
That is when they need to get an earlier repeat colonoscopy. That'd be at 3 years.
Yep. 3 or more is at 3 years. Let's say you find an advanced adenoma. First off, what is an advanced adenoma and what do those patients need?
There's a few characteristics that define advanced adenoma. Some of them are greater than 1 centimeter, high-grade dysplasia, or villous elements. In these patients, you'd want to also get a repeat colonoscopy at 3 years.
Okay, let's say your pathology report comes back on, you find a little polyp, you perform an endoscopic resection, and it comes back as hyperplastic polyp. What do you tell that patient?
10 years.
Yep. So that's considered normal. So considered to have a normal exam. Hyperplastic polyps do not need increased screening.
And just remember, 1 to 2 tubular adenomas, just a single tubular adenoma, get a repeat colonoscopy in 5 years. I think that's highly testable.
Yep. Tubular adenoma, 5 years. Hyperplastic polyp is normal. So another thing you'll see pop up frequently are the management of malignant polyps. So it'll ask you if you can manage these endoscopically, if they need a resection. So what are some key principles when it comes to that?
Yeah, so you're not necessarily obligated to a surgical resection. You want to think about a couple criteria to see if this polyp can be managed endoscopically. So first, can the polyp be removed in one piece? Second, are the resection margins clear, free of dysplasia or cancer? Third, the lesion is well or moderately differentiated with no lymphovascular invasion. And fourth, this is limited submucosal invasion. So cancer cells 2 millimeters or less past the muscularis mucosa. If all four of those criteria are met, then you can manage these endoscopically. However, for malignant polyps that do not meet these criteria or cannot be removed via endoscopic techniques, you are obligated to do an oncologic resection.
Yep. So those are great. So that's the key to managing endoscopic management of malignant polyps. It can be removed in one piece. The margins are free of dysplasia or cancer. It has to be well or moderately differentiated with no lymphovascular invasion and limited submucosal invasion. So cancer cells less than 2 millimeters past the muscularis mucosa. Anything that doesn't meet those criteria, they need a formal oncologic resection.
And I've seen they'll give you, so a pedunculated polyp, it can have submucosal invasion, the very limited submucosal invasion. But if you have a sessile polyp, any submucosal invasion, given the nature of a sessile polyp, is an indication for colectomy.
All right, so let's just jump right in and continue with colon cancer. So staging. Staging is painful, but this is one of the ones that you absolutely need to know. So Wu, walk us through the tumor stage and the T staging for your colon cancers.
Yeah, so the T stage for colon cancer, so TIS or in situ involves the lamina propria only. T1 invades the submucosa, T2 invades the muscularis propria, T3 invades through the muscularis propria and into the pericolonic tissue, and T4A penetrates the serosa, T4B invades or is adherent to surrounding structures.
Okay, keep going. Nodal staging. What are your end stages for colorectal cancer?
Yeah, so first we got to note that positive lymph nodes are defined as a 0.2 millimeter deposit of cancer cells. N1 disease is 1 to 3 nodes. N2A is 4 or more nodes, and N2B is 7 or more nodes.
Yep, 1 to 3, 4, and 7 is how that's broken up. Okay, M staging, once again, I love the M staging. M0, no distant metastasis. M1, distant metastasis. So when it comes to staging, there's a lot of different subtypes. There's stage 3A, 3B, 3C. Important to know, but for the boards, I would at least know, you know, your stage 1 or is your T1 or T1 to T2 lesion without any nodes. So that's if the tumor invades the submucosa or the tumor invades the muscularis propria. So that's T1, 2, N0, M0, that's stage 1. Stage 2, you're moving into your more advanced T stages, T3, T4, but again, no nodes, no metastasis. Stage 3 is when you start seeing nodes pop up. So any T stage, you have positive nodes, no metastasis, and stage 4 is obviously distant metastasis. So just know that basic breakdown is good enough for the boards. When it comes to your oncologic resection, Kevin, what kind of margins are you shooting for?
So for this, you want to have ideally a 5 to 7 centimeter margin.
Yeah, that's a pretty wide margin. So why is that important?
Right. This is to ensure that you have an adequate lymphadenectomy. So if you're getting this big of a margin, your lymph node supply to this area is likely going to be adequate.
Another key to that, not just the margin, but is also taking the vascular supply, correct? Because if you take the vascular supply, you're gonna get your adequate lymphadenectomy. What's the minimum number of nodes you need in your lymphadenectomy for colon cancer?
Very key, and it's 12.
Yep, the number is 12. You need 12 nodes. So something that's frequently asked is how you want to manage a patient who presents with stage 4 disease. So how do you think about these patients, Wu?
So I like to break these apart into kind of three broad categories. One is resectable. Two is it might be resectable if you're able to downstage it with chemotherapy. And a third would be unresectable disease. So let's start with the unresectable patients. In these patients, surgery is really only indicated for palliative purposes. So if they have obstruction, bleeding, or perforation, you could do palliative surgery. Or if they're obstructed, you can also do stenting. That's a possible option, which might be preferable to colectomy or diversion. Looking at the resectable patients, so in medically fit patients, curative resection of hepatic and or pulmonary metastases can be performed. And so for these patients, you would give a sequence of chemotherapy and resect the primary tumor in addition to the metastasis. For the patients who have potentially resectable disease, so again, these are patients where giving chemotherapy might downstage the patient. You want to give preoperative full FOX and then reevaluate the resectability based on the response.
Yeah, so unresectable is easy. Those patients, our surgery is reserved only for their palliation. Resectable, there's a lot out there about how you deal with metastasis, whether you deal with the primary first, whether you deal with the metastasis first, whether you deal with them at the same time, whether you give preoperative chemotherapy. That's getting a little bit into the weeds, and that's going to vary widely by surgeon, institution, and the individual patient and tumor characteristics. However, for me personally on the exam, if I were given the answer, or if I were given a resectable colon cancer that has hepatic metastasis, I would give a short 3-month course of preoperative full FOX therapy if it's an option, resect, and then 3 months of post-op full FOX therapy is what I would do.
So you would resect both the colon cancer and the hepatic metastasis at the same time?
That's gonna depend a lot on the tumor. If it's a small tumor hanging out in segment 2 or 3 of the liver, I think that's an acceptable answer to do them both at the same time. I don't think they're gonna get into the weeds with that on the exam because it's just so variable depending on the individual tumor characteristics. And again, it depends on the institution and what you have available and the particular surgeon.
Yeah, I would choose yes, resect both on the abside. I feel like it could come up. But I think if it's easily resectable, you do both at the same time.
Okay, what about adjuvant therapy? Who gets adjuvant therapy?
So in general, anyone with stage 3 and above, so even a single positive node or any M1 disease.
Yeah, and there's a lot of some evidence coming out there that adjuvant therapy may be beneficial for those high-risk stage 2 diseases, those T4 lesions, if they present with perforation obstruction, poorly differentiated, or you have an inadequate less than 12 nodal harvest. However, for the boards, I would stick to adjuvant therapy for stage 3 and above disease. And what's your adjuvant regimen?
So standard is full FOX for 6 months. That's folinic acid, essentially leucovorin, 5-FU and oxaliplatin. Additionally, you can do 3 months pre-op and then 3 months post-op.
Yep, perfect. So full FOX therapy for 6 months. Okay, let's move on to rectal cancer.
But wait, what about radiation?
Well, I don't know, Kevin. What about radiation for colon cancer?
Radiation is not indicated in any colon cancer, especially for the boards.
Yeah, for colon cancers, you want to stay away from radiation. We're going to get into radiotherapy for rectal cancer here in a couple of minutes. So that's a perfect segue into our rectal cancer discussion. So Wu, how do you want to approach these patients, these rectal cancers? How do you want to work them up?
Yeah, so preoperatively, you want to get labs to include a CEA level. You want to do a rigid proctoscopy to gauge the level of the tumor. And then you want to do a CT with chest, abdomen, and pelvis for complete staging. And finally, you can do endorectal ultrasound or rectal MRI, and that gives you a good assessment of the circumferential resection margin.
Yeah, so talk to me a little bit about that. So that's a little bit different than colon cancer. You want to do, all your things, get your CEA, your CT oncology, your chest, abdomen, pelvis. But the specific things you mentioned, those endoscopic ultrasounds or the rectal MRI, the rigid proctoscopy, why is that important?
So the CRM is the total distance between the tumor and the mesorectal fascia. It's a very important prognostic indicator.
And you just want to make sure that a big reason for the endorectal ultrasound and the rectal MRI is to determine the T stage of the cancer.
Yeah, so a lot to unpack there, but definitely rigid proctoscopy because you need to get a good idea of what level you're dealing with. You're dealing with rectal cancer because that might affect the procedure you're going to do or how you're going to approach this patient. And as Kevin said, it's very, very important to know your T stage and know your N stage. So why, Kevin? Why is it so important to know that with rectal cancer?
Will determine what type of therapy they get, whether neoadjuvant versus surgical upfront.
Yeah, so who gets neoadjuvant chemorads in rectal cancer?
So locally advanced tumor of the mid or distal rectum, T3 or greater, or any node positive disease will definitely get neoadjuvant.
Yep, that's what you need to know for the board. So T3 disease or any N disease gets neoadjuvant chemorads. And what's your chemorad regimen?
So this is where you're going to get 5,000 gray of radiotherapy delivered concurrently while they are undergoing 5-FU chemotherapy delivered over 5 to 6 weeks.
Yeah, 5,000 centigrade concurrently with 5FU over 5 to 6 weeks. And then when do you want to perform your resection after neoadjuvant therapy?
Generally 2 to 3 months after they finish this neoadjuvant therapy. And I think it's important to note that the 5FU is actually a sensitizer for the radiation is some things that I've seen come up.
Oh, perfect. Good point. Okay, let's start talking about some surgical management of rectal cancer. First off, Wu, you'll hear about local excision for rectal cancer. When is local excision an option?
So in select patients who have T1 lesions without high-risk features, so these are well to moderately differentiated lesions with no lymphovascular or perineural invasion, less than 3 centimeters in size, and less than a third of the circumference of the bowel lumen.
So T1 lesions, no lymphovascular or perineural invasion, well to moderately differentiated, less than 3 centimeters, less than one third. It needs to be all of those things before you even consider local excision. So what's the big drawback of a local excision?
The biggest drawback is that you're not able to pathologically examine the regional lymph nodes.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's why, having a frank discussion with the patient is important with this. So they need to be able to understand that there's up to a 20% local recurrence rate after a local excision for a T1 lesion. So for that situation, if the patient's a good surgical candidate, I would probably lean to answering a formal resection because you get that formal oncologic resection, you can evaluate the lymph nodes. But you may see this show up on the board. So it's not necessarily a wrong answer to answer local excision for those lesions. And in reality, even some T2 lesions are being locally excised in very poor surgical candidates, but I definitely wouldn't answer that way on the boards. So what's your approach to a rectal cancer that, let's say, it's in the upper third of the rectum? What's your surgical approach for that?
So these, you're going to be able to preserve their rectum and their continence. And so you're going to be able to do a low anterior resection, focusing on a quality mesorectal dissection with a 5 centimeter distal margin.
Yeah. So you want a tumor specific mesorectal excision with a 5 centimeter margin and an anastomosis. Okay, good. How about Wu if it's in the mid to lower third of the rectum?
Yeah. So this is where you start to get into that zone where a LAR may not be possible and you may need to think about APR, but, you're still going to do that total mesorectal excision as part of an LAR or an APR. And with the TME, you're going to get 2 centimeter distal margins ideally, but if it's really distal, even 1 centimeter is okay.
Yep. So for your lower rectal cancers, you need that. You really need that total mesorectal excision as part of either an LAR or an APR. With your total mesorectal excision, 2 centimeter margins is if ideal. If you're really encroaching on those sphincter, 1 centimeter is okay. But certainly, if you can't get that margin, the patient needs an APR. Okay, so Kevin, for adjuvant therapy, who with rectal cancer, who gets adjuvant therapy, and what's your regimen?
So it's similar to colon cancer, and you're going to use FOLFOX again, and you want to give adjuvant therapy to patients that have stage 3 or greater who did not receive neoadjuvant therapy.
Yeah, so let's reiterate that point. So we mentioned earlier the patients who are stage 3 or people who have T3 disease or any N disease are going to get neoadjuvant therapy. But now you're saying patients who are stage 3 who did not receive neoadjuvant therapy or get adjuvant therapy. Unpack that a little bit for me. What are we saying?
Right. So on their initial preoperative workup, they were not noted to be node positive or stage 3, but on pathologic examination, some patients are upstaged. So the pathologic stage would be stage 3, and then they would need adjuvant therapy.
Yeah. So in other words, the patients who are understaged, who present with stage 3 disease and makes sense, are going to get adjuvant therapy. How about patients who received new adjuvant therapy? Which of those patients get adjuvant therapy?
Right. So high risk stage 2 and stage 3 patients will also get adjuvant therapy.
Yeah. So we're really assuming that the stage 2 disease is a result of downstaging by neoadjuvant therapy. So those patients also get adjuvant therapy. Okay. So moving down the line. So we've talked about colon cancer. We've talked about rectal cancer. Let's talk about your anal squamous neoplasms. So these can be a little bit confusing because there's a lot of histologic variants. So what are some variants that you're likely to see in the stem of a question, Will?
The variants that you're looking for are cloacogenic, basaloid, epidermoid and mucoepidermoid.
Yeah, and it's kind of painful, but you have to know those because they're not going to tell you that the patient has an anal squamous neoplasm. They're going to say that you get a biopsy and you see an epidermoid lesion. So you need to know these because they're going to try and trick you. They're going to give you, like I said, they're going to give you an anal mass that was biopsied. You have to recognize that you're dealing with really anal squamous cell cancer.
Yeah, they're going to try to get you to answer an APR, but that is not the correct answer with these patients.
Yeah, so what are these patients? Why is that? What are these patients? How do you treat these patients?
Because they primarily need chemo radiotherapy up front.
Right, so chemo-RAS is going to be the answer, not APR. So you need to know those histologic variants because they will try to trick you. So what are some associations with anal squamous cancer?
The key are HPV serotypes 16 and 18. Additionally, there's a higher incidence in immunosuppressed patients.
So let's talk a little bit about anal intraepithelial neoplasm, so AIN. This is a precursor to squamous cell cancer. There's a lot of confusing classification systems out there, but how can we break that down to understand it?
So there's a few things you need to know. AIN 1, 2, and 3 correspond to low, moderate, and high-grade dysplasia, respectively. So low-grade AIN is 1 and 2, high-grade is 3.
Yeah, you'll see that in the literature, you'll see that broken down in a number of confusing ways, but I think that makes the most sense. So low-grade AIN is AIN 1, 2, high-grade AIN type 3. So Wu, you mentioned that the primary treatment for a squamous cell cancer of the anal canal is chemo-RADS. Most people probably know this by the NIGRO protocol, but what is that?
Yeah, the NIGRO protocol is 5-FU, mitomycin C, and 3,000 centigrade of XRT. And in reality, multiple regimens exist, but this is the standard one.
Yeah, it's way more complicated than that, as most things in surgical oncology are. But that's the classic. That's the NIGRO protocol. It's the one everybody knows. That's the one that you should know and be able to rattle off. Okay, so we say you don't treat these patients with APR, but let's say you treat them with the NIGRO protocol or some variant, and they have either persistent squamous cell cancer after treatment, or let's say they have a recurrence. How do you manage those patients?
Yeah, these patients you would need to do an APR.
Yeah, so those are the patients that get a salvage APR. Okay, so when we talked earlier about how important it is to know your anal rectal anatomy, we talked about the anal margin. So what defines the anal margin, Wu?
So that's going to be 5 centimeters extending radially from the mucosquamous junction.
Okay. And so let's say you have a squamous cell cancer of the anal margin. Do those patients get the NIGRO protocol, or how do you treat those patients?
No, you can actually treat these like a skin cancer with wide local excision.
Correct. So once again, just important to know the anatomy. Those are the ways that they're going to try and trip you up when it talks about squamous cell cancer of the anal canal. What about treatment of, like, Kevin, you broke down that low-grade AIN, that high-grade AIN. How do you want to treat those patients?
So overall, it has a low rate of conversion to squamous cell cancer, but it is higher in immunosuppressed patients. So several local treatments can be used. You can use local therapies such as topical imiquimod, topical 5-FU, photodynamic therapy, and targeted destruction. But probably most important part of any of these treatments is close clinical follow-up with surveillance every 4 to 6 months.
Yeah, it's really hard to predict which one of those. We know there's a higher conversion rate in patients who are like HIV patients or patients who are immunocompromised. Overall, though, it's a pretty low conversion rate. There's a lot of local therapies out there. There's not a whole lot of evidence favoring one over the other. And probably, like you said, the most important thing is the close surveillance and being on a close surveillance regimen to document any of those conversions.
Right. In high-risk patients, these are kind of the patients you do what they call the anal pap smear. Jason, what about melanoma in the anal canal?
So anal melanoma is not uncommon. So those patients are treated typically with a resection, so an APR. All right. So that is wrapping up our colorectal review for the abside and the boards. It's a huge topic. It's a lot to cover, but we tried to break it down to what's most relevant for the abside and the boards. So let's wrap it up with our quick hits, rapid fire segment. So Wu, let's say you have a transverse colon cancer with local invasion of the head of the pancreas and no evidence of metastatic disease. How do you treat that patient?
So this would be an en bloc resection. You would need to do a Whipple with an extended hemicolectomy.
Right. So that's not unresectable disease. So if local invasion, you do an en bloc resection, even if that means doing a Whipple. So Kevin, let's say you have an isolated peritoneal carcinomatosis secondary to colon cancer. How do you treat that patient?
So carcinomatosis is considered widespread metastasis. However, if isolated, you can do cytoreductive surgery and intraperitoneal chemotherapy.
Perfect. Those are your HIPAC protocols. Let's say you have rectal cancer. They undergo neoadjuvant therapy, and it looks like they have a complete clinical response. Do those patients still need a resection?
Yes, they do. They still require resection because the current imaging, the CT, MRI, PET, can't reliably predict a complete pathologic response.
Yeah, that's a big question. How do you know you have a complete clinical response if you don't have a pathology specimen? So it's a little bit controversial, but especially on the boards, those definitely patients still need a resection. Kevin, so you're in clinic, you have a patient that's referred for a hemorrhoid. However, on exam, you find a 1 centimeter palpable mass of the anal canal. You perform a biopsy, appropriately so, and it returns as a epidermoid carcinoma. What do you want to do with that patient?
For this patient, I would do primary chemoradiotherapy, such as the NIGRO protocol. This is a variant of squamous cell carcinoma.
Yep, that's why you have to know those different histologic variants, because that's the way they're going to ask that question, an epidermoid carcinoma or basaloid or one of those. And you have to recognize that squamous cell, and that gets chemorads, not a resection. Woo. You have a patient who had a prior proctocolectomy with ileopouch anal anastomosis for ulcerative colitis. He presents with fever, pelvic pain, increased frequency of stools, and you do a flexible endoscopy, which shows mucosal inflammation of the ileopouch. What's your diagnosis?
Pouchitis.
What's your treatment?
So I'll start with antibiotics, ciprofloxacin, and supportive care.
What's another option?
So if the patient does not respond to antibiotics, next line would be budesonide enemas.
Okay. So let's say you have a patient that has either recurrent or chronic pouchitis. What are you thinking then?
Yeah, that makes you think of the patient being misdiagnosed, and this patient actually has Crohn's disease and not ulcerative colitis.
Good, good. And what about for your patient that has refractory pouchitis and it's just not getting better, or they just can't live with it anymore? What do you sometimes have to do with these patients?
That would warrant a pouch excision and ileostomy.
Right. Sometimes you have to think about taking your pouch down, and maybe the patient's quality of life would be better with an end ileostomy. That's certainly a difficult decision. Kevin, so during a laparoscopic exploration for presumed acute appendicitis, your appendix appears normal, but the TI looks inflamed. What are you thinking then?
So this patient has likely Crohn's disease, but if the cecum is uninvolved, I would do an appendectomy to prevent future diagnostic confusion. If the cecum is inflamed, I would leave the appendix in place. Either way, treat medically for acute Crohn's flare.
Yeah, so that common comes up. And it's not an uncommon situation to find yourself in. So the appendix appears normal. If the cecum appears normal, still take the appendix. If the cecum's inflamed, back away slowly. And either way, you treat those patients for their Crohn's flare. All right, so that does it. That's colorectal for the abside and the boards. Big topic, but hopefully that was useful for you guys. We'll see you next time.